This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The mid-20th century saw famine and starvation in several parts of the world. The Great Depression meant that many couldn't afford to feed their families, and low food prices caused many desperate farmers in the U.S. to destroy their own products in an attempt to manipulate markets. Food scarcity in China was largely responsible for the Chinese Civil War, and the global political instability that led to World War II was fueled in part by hunger as well. Enter Norman Borlaug, an American agronomist who worked tirelessly through the 20th century to fight world hunger by developing breeding and growing techniques that maximized crop yields and led to the so-called Green Revolution that's said to have prevented over a billion deaths. His work earned him many awards, including the Nobel Peace Prize, but it drastically changed how the world farms. Tonight, PBS's American Experience profiles Norman Borlaug in a documentary called The Man Who Tried to Feed the World. Historian and Indiana University professor Nick Culleather is featured in the documentary. He's the author of The Hungry World, America's Cold War Battle Against Poverty in Asia. Nick Culleather, it's great to have you with us.
Great to be here, Matt.
And we are live today, so if you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment. We'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881 or on social media at All In Indiana. So, Nick, I did my best to paint the picture there at the top, but I hope you can help us fill in the gaps this hour. Let's start at the beginning. In the early years of the 20th century, where and why did food scarcity start to really become a problem?
Yeah, the Rockefeller Foundation identified food scarcity as a problem that was capable of solution pretty early on in the 1920s. And they did this largely because there had been newly developed tools in the science of nutrition, and particularly the invention of the calorie. Because once you had a calorie, it dispelled a lot of myths about food and eating on the one hand. It had previously been thought, for instance, that different people in different parts of the world and different races ate different things because they were genetically different. The calorie disproved that. It indicated that everybody needs the same amount of food, and the amount of food you need depends on how much work you do. And so consequently, they began to imagine the possibility of managing the world food supply. And the Rockefeller Foundation identified this in the 1920s as one area in which American technology and American know-how could really make a difference.
Have we uncovered has there been speculation on other motives from the Rockefeller Foundation as to why they wanted to get into this work?
Well, the U.S. State Department was interested in it very early on, and the U.S. government in general. As soon as Wilbur Atwater began doing the studies to identify the calorie count of various foods, the so-called Atwater tables, which are on the sides of every cereal box that you have that indicate how many calories there are in a particular food. Once they began to do that, various people in the government recognized that you could manage prisons, armies, hospitals, and you could very precisely indicate how much food was necessary in a particular situation and how much food was surplus. And so it allowed American agricultural managers to begin to look at the American food supply and say that there was actually a lot of it. There was enough food that we could export safely a fair amount of food. This was crucial in World War I when we were trying to feed not just the American army overseas, but America's allies as well, without creating food shortages in the United States. And so the science of food management really began to take off. So the Rockefeller Foundation began investing heavily in that. They began taking a look overseas at other countries, particularly places in Asia. China had an endemic problem with famine. What would happen, they thought, if the United States were to try to help out? And they could imagine a couple of different ways in which the United States could do that. One is we could ship surplus food overseas, something we began to do during the Cold War. But the other was to send technology overseas. And to export American know-how about how to produce food.
So I guess before we can understand everything that was going on at that time, I want to talk about the economics of farming. At the time of this story, there were a lot of innovations in farming that seemed to make things easier on the farmer. What was the problem with that?
Yeah, so scientific agriculture was a bit of a mixed blessing, because the more food you produce, particularly in a surplus situation, the lower the price gets for the farmer. So it's not always the case that if a farmer produces more, if they breed better crops, if they use their ingenuity and even mechanization and other things to produce more crops, that it actually benefits the farmer. Usually it doesn't. And in the Depression, that crisis, which is known in the farming community as the paradox of plenty. In other words, the more you produce, the less you make, became particularly acute. Farmers were producing more than they ever had before, and consequently, prices were falling through the bottom. It's a little bit like the oil situation that we have today, where we have now a negative price of oil. Similar things were happening in the farming community in the Plains states and in the Midwest. Farmers were having to sell their crops for less than it cost to make them. And to some extent, they blamed agricultural science for that. And this was at the time that Norman Borlaug was graduating from college and looking forward to a career as an agricultural scientist. And he was emerging into a world in which a lot of farmers blamed scientists for their plight. And in particular, some of the people who worked with the Rockefeller Foundation, Borlaug's teacher, Alvin Stakeman, had been instrumental in identifying the causes of wheat rust and eliminating wheat rust. And the cause was an interesting one. It was a particular imported shrub called the barberry bush, which harbors rust spores. It's a fungus. At some stage in its lifestyle. And by eradicating these bushes, you could dramatically reduce the amount of crop losses due to these devastating wheat blights. And various congressmen in the 1930s said, we ought to bring those bushes back because what it was causing was more and more farmers to go out of business. What they needed was some scarcity in order to drive up the price of food. So in many ways, when Borlaug took the Rockefeller Foundation's offer to go to Mexico and to begin to work on agricultural science down there, he was leaving behind a country that really didn't respect his profession and what he was doing in America, and taking that somewhere where it was appreciated.
We are talking to historian and Indiana University professor Nick Culleather, who's featured in the PBS documentary The Man Who Tried to Feed the World, which premieres tonight at 8 p.m. He's also the author of The Hungry World, America's Cold War Battle Against Poverty in Asia. And we are taking your questions and comments to Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or voicemail at 866-476-3881. So Norman Borlaug was hired through the Rockefeller Foundation to head down to Mexico and find a solution, a way around stem rust fungus. So then how did he find his way around? Was it a long process?
It was a very long process. And it really took place in two stages. The first was to conquer the disease. And that was a question of identifying strains and varieties that were resistant to disease and figuring out ways in which you could grow wheat with irrigation that didn't invite stem rust in. And so he developed a number of strains that did that. He used a particular technique known as shuttle breeding, which was revolutionary at the time, where Mexico is a large enough country that it has multiple climates, and he was able to do one growing season on the central Mexican plateau and then go north near the U.S. border to the province of Sonora and have another wheat growing season within the same year there. And that cut in half the amount of time that it took to develop new varieties. And within a few years, by the late 1940s, he was becoming successful in in developing those strains. The reason it was so important to grow more food in Mexico was not because Mexicans were starving. They were actually exporting a lot of agricultural produce to the United States, as they do today. I mean, if you go in an American grocery store, you'll see a lot of grapes and fruit and vegetables and other things that come from Mexico. That was the same way in those days. But during the war, the United States wanted Mexico to begin to grow crops crucial to the war effort, particularly rubber. The American rubber supplies were cut off by the Japanese in Asia. Hemp, which was used for rope, very crucial war material. All of these things had to be grown in Mexico. And so when they did that, it pushed food off of the farms in Mexico. And so in order to feed the Mexican people and to produce a food surplus there in a situation in which most of the land was now being devoted to war crops, the work of the Rockefeller Foundation became particularly important.
And so that ended up producing what some called miracle wheat, which then ended up producing what they called the complete wheat through crossbreeding with numerous strains of wheat and dwarf wheat. Did Borlaug patent any of this?
No, he didn't. He well could have. Nowadays, it's considered to be intellectual property, but the whole relationship between innovations in plant breeding and intellectual property is a really interesting history. With most manufactured goods, when somebody puts their own ingenuity and intellect into something and invents something entirely new, they can patent it. With varieties of crops, typically it hasn't been the case that they do that. Instead, it just gets folded into a commodity called called wheat or rice or corn, and the farmer gains no benefit from the intellectual property that they own in their crop.
IU professor Nick Culleather is our guest today. He's featured in the PBS American Experience documentary, The Man Who Tried to Feed the World, which premieres tonight at 8 p.m. We are live and we are welcoming your questions and comments on today's discussion at All in Indiana on Facebook or Twitter, or you can send us a voicemail to 866-476-3881. Up next, we'll talk about Norman Borlaug's trip to Asia and what happened next. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking with Indiana University professor of history Nick Culleather, who is featured in the PBS American Experience documentary, The Man Who Tried to Feed the World, which premieres tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern on your local PBS station. He's also the author of The Hungry World, America's Cold War Battle Against Poverty in Asia. So, Nick, it's easy to point to population growth as a cause for all of this priority to improve the world food supply. But you say that wasn't really the case. Why?
Yeah, that's a legend that really got started with the citation for Norman Borlaug's Nobel Peace Prize. The Nobel Committee credited him with solving the world population explosion. By inventing a technology that allowed food supply to keep up with population growth and end the Malthusian menace. And so the legend that they created was the idea that right after World War II, scientists took a look at what they saw as a global baby boom unfolding around the world and realized that food production wouldn't keep up. And so they snapped into action, developed a research program to solve that problem. And governments recognized the need to follow their lead and undertook to implement what came to be called the Green Revolution. In fact, what I've found in my research is that it began much earlier, as I've said, in the 1920s, when population was declining due to the pandemic and due to World War I, and then remaining flat during the 1930s due to the Depression. So it actually wasn't food, the scarcity of food that was driving this. It was the ability to transfer a technology that people overseas that people would value and that would enable them to industrialize in some ways. So the model of Mexico, in which you could grow food on fewer acres and devote the rest of the acres to producing industrial crops, became something that was very much of interest to Asia, because Asia was engaged in a breakneck industrialization drive after World War II, as newly independent countries tried to take their place in the world and become modern nations. And China, we know, had a revolution in 1949 that was driven in large part by food scarcity. And India, emerging from years of colonization, was also having a chronic problem with food scarcity, but which was also under-industrialized. And both of those two giants were attempting to rapidly industrialize. And that was putting a tremendous strain on their farms, because they were trying to grow crops other than food. So in India, for instance, most of the best watered acres were being devoted to cotton and jute, which is the fabric that goes into making burlap, both of which were high-value export crops. And that meant fewer acres could be devoted to food. And so the deficit had to be made up by food exports from the United States.
But indeed, I mean, the world population did end up going up. I mean, as you cite, I mean, the baby boom, it seems like that was all too convenient for the other motives that had begun in the earlier part of the 20th century.
Yeah, it's important to recognize, though, that high population growth and even food scarcity is not really a cause of famine. There was a group of scholars in the 1980s led by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen, who formed something called the Famine Studies Movement, that did a thorough look into what are the causes of famine. And what they found was that in all cases, in situations of famine, there is an abundance of food. That's an observation that people have seen throughout history. Jonathan Swift, who wrote Gulliver's Travels, was a reporter in Ireland during the Irish potato famine. And he noted that during, you know, you could go to an Irish port and right next to the coffin ships that were taking away the refugees from the Irish famine to America were other ships that were taking away beef and mutton that was grown on Irish farms for sale in England. So it's not shortages of food that cause hunger. It's shortages of other things. Amartya Sen said it's really a shortage of freedom that causes that. Norman Borlaug, to some extent, recognized this. So the need for the United States was to try to persuade India and other allied countries that what they needed to do was to adjust the price structure within their economy so that they could simultaneously industrialize and grow enough food locally to feed their people. And to do that, you had to set up an entire system of price controls, warehouses, price supports, and market regulations in order to make farming profitable. And that was the drive that Norman Borlaug undertook in the 1960s.
What kind of pushback did he get on that?
So initially, they thought he was crazy. It's hard to imagine this now, but in the 1950s, the economic orthodoxy said that India was growing too much food. And here's the logic for that. If you can grow a crop on your land that produces more money per acre than food, you can then use that money to buy food from abroad. And food on international markets was relatively cheap. So the industrial plan for India was for it to concentrate on manufacturing. to sell manufactured goods to Southeast Asia and to Africa, and to use the revenues that they would earn in export earnings to buy food overseas to import into India. And that's not such a crazy model. It's the way China works today. China doesn't grow enough food to feed all of the Chinese, but if they produce enough iPhones, they can buy all the food that they want from Kentucky, from Indiana, from other places. It's a manufacturing model that that works. The problem is making that transition. And in China, what they did was they had a totalitarian system that implemented a forced industrialization drive and led to something called the Great Leap Forward famines of the late 1950s, in which they devoted so much effort to industrialism that agriculture languished. And consequently, there were mass food shortages around the country in which millions of people died. So India needed to make a similar transition. And that was a transition in thinking, but also a big transition in policy that meant that they needed to stop devoting government and private money to in industry and to shift those resources into growing food. And Borlaug saw the new varieties of wheat as the catalyst for that policy change. It was a dramatic enough change in how much food you could grow per acre, but the drama of it was more important in some ways than the reality of it. He realized that the technology itself wasn't going to make the change that was necessary. What was needed was the policy change that would cause people to think twice about growing cotton and instead plant wheat or rice on their land instead. And in 1966, with tremendous pressure from Lyndon Johnson on the Indira Gandhi administration, the Indian government made that transition.
We're talking to Indiana University professor of history Nick Culleather, who is the author of The Hungry World, America's Cold War Battle Against Poverty in Asia. He's also featured in the PBS American Experience documentary, The Man Who Tried to Feed the World, which premieres tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern on PBS. Nick, there's a great quote in the documentary tonight. It sums up the U.S.'s interest in this kind of food science. One of the commentators said, "No one becomes a communist on a full belly." What do they mean by that?
Now, that was a slogan that a lot of Americans began to repeat throughout the Cold War. You see, in addition to the arms race and the space race, there was also a development race that was key to the Cold War. Both the United States and the communist world were putting forward an economic vision that the rest of the world was watching. They would either adopt a market-oriented capitalist system in the United States or a command economy like the one that was being implemented in China. And those command economies had tremendous appeal for people around the world. They took a look at the way in which the Soviet Union went from being a poor agricultural country to being a leader in technology and nuclear power in just a very few decades. And so a lot of leaderships of new countries saw that as the best option for them. What the United States began to do was to say, look, they know how to run an industrial economy, but they don't know how to grow food. And food is what is really most important to people. And so the slogan that that free men eat better, as John Foster Dulles put it, was part of the American development message. And the United States differentiated itself from the Soviet Union in the aid and development assistance that they provided to other countries by saying, look, we'll let the Soviets work on things like building your soccer stadium and building up urban infrastructure and housing projects. But what we're going to do is we're going to help your farmers. And consequently, you're going to have modern, nutritious food supply. And so people experienced American aid in a very different way. In India, for instance, there was a new type of bread that was made out of American wheat and American milk powder, and it was called modern bread, and it came in a cellophane wrapper, and it came in many different flavors of bread, coriander being one of them, to suit the Indian palate. And a lot of people who are my age now remember that in India, remember that new bread appearing in the stores. And that was a consequence of American, what was called PL480 aid, the Food for Peace program.
We are talking about the so-called Green Revolution of the mid-20th century, and we will take your questions and comments to Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or via voicemail at 866-476-3881. We're on with IU Professor of History Nick Culleather. Let's stay in India here and talk more about Norman Borlaug. His role essentially went from scientist to salesman in India. What do we mean by that?
That's right. So as I said, what he had to do was not just to persuade Indian farmers to use his new wheat varieties. He had to persuade the government to offer the kind of price supports to the farmer in order to make it profitable for the farmer to grow food instead of growing industrial crops. And so consequently, he barnstormed around the country, meeting with government officials, showing them the new wheat, and setting up demonstration farms. And in 1966, 1965 rather, they made an effort to plant a million acres across India in demonstration farms to show what the new wheat varieties could do. And there was a dramatic moment when he tried to get the seed wheat to come from Mexico to the port of Calcutta in order to distribute it in India. And it happened at a particular moment. They needed to get the wheat there quickly because seed wheat will germinate in the bags in the hold of a ship unless you get it there in a very relatively short period of time. So they bagged it up in Mexico. They took it across the border to the port of Los Angeles just in time for the Watts riots to break out. The entire city was shut down by the rioting and by the police response to it. The trucks, Borlaug eventually found them, were on a siding alongside a highway outside of Los Angeles. He finally managed to get them through the city to the port and onto a ship. They then went to India and arrived just in time for a war between India and Pakistan, which had broken out. So the ship was caught in the port, which was under bombardment at the time. Finally, they managed to get it out. A few of the bags had sprouted, but the rest of them were good. They distributed them across India, and within a few months, they had a dramatic demonstration of what the new wheat varieties could do.
And so his methods, Norman Borlaug's methods, ended up dramatically increasing India's food supply, which was good for the time. But what did it mean for India's farmers?
Well, it often meant a lot of them weren't going to be in the farming business anymore. There was a huge transition as farming families, which had formerly grown cotton or grown other crops, were pushed off the land. Many of them were tenants, and into industrial jobs in the cities. And to some extent, this was planned. The Rockefeller Foundation, as early as the 1930s, talked about the way in which underdeveloped countries like India needed to have a migration from the countryside to the cities in order to create a labor force for industry. What happened instead was that there were other farmers, wealthier farmers, often retired military people in India who would invest in land in the neighborhood of cities and who would grow wheat on larger tracts. So you had a kind of a turnover in who was doing the farming and who was owning the land. And so it led to a lot of dislocation, a lot of social collapse in villages across India. And its chief effect, the one that we can really attribute to the transition in agriculture, is the urbanization of Asia. You know, it's hard to imagine this today, but at the end of World War II, there were maybe three or four cities that were as large as Indianapolis is now in all of Asia. The entire population was rural. By the late 1960s, that was beginning to change, and you had cities of multi-millions of people.
We'll get into
of course, there are mega cities of 60 million or more people.
We'll get into more of that after we take a break. We are talking with IU professor of history, Nick Culleather. He's the author of The Hungry World, America's Cold War Battle Against Poverty in Asia, and he's featured in the PBS American Experience documentary, The Man Who Tried to Feed the World, which premieres tonight at 8 p.m. We are taking your questions or comments on Facebook, Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about the so-called Green Revolution of the mid-20th century. It's the subject of a new PBS American Experience documentary called The Man Who Tried to Feed the World, centering around American agronomist Norman Borlaug. Our guest today is IU professor of history, Nick Culleather. He's also the author of The Hungry World, America's Cold War Battle Against Poverty in Asia, and he's featured in the documentary tonight. We are live today, so if you have questions or comments on our show, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Nick, where we left off was the transformation of Asia from a largely rural society into what we know it to be today, cities of millions and millions of people. Some of the largest cities in the world are Asia, are in Asia. And it's easy to point to Borlaug as kind of a reason for a lot of this. But his goals, personally, were pretty focused. Find a way to grow more food. There were plenty of political forces at work here, too, though. What else was behind all of this?
Well, the Cold War was a major aspect of it. In fact, the name of it, the Green Revolution, was a name that was chosen by American officials to contrast with the Red Revolution that the communists were advocating. So the communists were advocating industrialization and land reform. And the United States said, look, we've got a Green Revolution, too, which is made of technology. And it means more food on your plate. And it means you know, more a better livelihood for everyone in your country, and so it was a very concrete attempt to manifest the difference between the American system and the communist system. But there were other aspects as well. The Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation were particularly worried about increases in population around the world, and as the Green Revolution was unfolding, they were also advocating for sterilization and birth control and contraception to be distributed, particularly in underdeveloped countries. And so some of the more rigorous regimes of population control were implemented at this time, China's famous one-child policy. But in India, Indira Gandhi implemented a system, a nationwide system of encouraged and sometimes forced sterilizations and mandatory birth control in order to limit population growth. In fact, the Green Revolution was so closely identified with these other American encouraged efforts that rumors spread in just about anywhere where new varieties of wheat were introduced, that the wheat itself was a contraceptive, that it caused people to stop having babies. And Norman Borlaug, who was a big supporter of family planning and birth control, said in answer to a question from a reporter about this, if that were true, we would really deserve the Nobel Peace Prize.
Interesting. Do we see any of that, those efforts, the birth control efforts and things like that, do any of those seem to have, I guess, worked to get us where we are now?
Well, it was, in many ways, it was based on a mistaken economic theory, which was debunked just a few years later. There was an idea that kind of started in the early 1960s among economists that population growth was a negative in terms of economic growth. Economists have changed their tune about that. By the late 1970s, they were realizing that population growth is actually a positive because it increases demand, right? And the more people there are, the more demand there is for goods, and consequently, the economy itself grows along with the population. So there was a kind of a change in ideology about that. But Norman Borlaug, in many ways, developed a set of ideas about what he was doing and the relationship to population growth that he stayed with throughout his entire life. And in some ways, it made him one of the least popular Nobel Peace Prize winners we've ever had. In Iowa, he's still very much revered. There are schools named after him and this kind of thing. But in the rest of the country, he really lost credibility in the early 1970s when he began to lobby for the re-legalization of DDT. I don't know if you remember that DDT was an insecticide that was widely used in the United States and that had a terrible effect on bird populations. The bald eagle was practically wiped out in the United States by the residue from DDT. And Rachel Carson wrote an influential book in the early 1960s called Silent Spring, in which really launched the environmental movement. And its first great victory was the banning of DDT. Norman Borlaug, coming very late to the game, began to fight against that and to advocate for the re-legalization. And in many ways, it showed, after his many years abroad, how out of tune he had become with American politics. The environmental movement was something he never understood. To him, it seemed that they were people who valued animals over human lives.
So Norman Borlaug is seen by many at this time, although we did just hear about the flip side of it. But he's seen by many. I mean, he did get the Nobel Peace Prize. He's seen as this altruistic person who didn't patent his work. He saved a billion lives, but he was myopic to his goals and had good intentions. He saw his contributions, though, not as an end all be all, but more of a temporary fix. What did he mean by that?
Yes. So he saw himself as buying time. In other words, creating maybe a couple of decades that the world would have in which to get its population house in order. If population growth couldn't be brought under control, the same dynamic he felt that led to famines in the late 1950s, early 1960s, would once again begin to cause famines around the world. Population growth continues to grow, although the rate of population growth has begun to decline. But as I say, one of the things that we've learned in the years since then is the relationship between food supply and population is not as neat as either the Nobel Committee or Norman Borlaug recognized. Really, what was causing the famines in the late 1950s and early 1960s was industrialization, and in many ways, tyranny. Having a communist government in India, one economist put it, there are two causes of famine in the world, in China and India, and they both begin with a C. One is communism and the other is caste. India's rigid caste system created people who were powerless and couldn't command the resources to buy food for themselves. So the food situation around the world has improved. Diets have been steadily getting better throughout the world. But we nonetheless see a lot of the same dynamics. Africa, for instance, exports a huge amount of food to Europe. Oranges, lemons, vegetables, salads, seafoods, even meats go from Africa to Europe. But it doesn't earn enough money for Africans often to eliminate the problem of malnutrition that's endemic in many parts of the continent. So the problems that we have nowadays are related very much to inequality rather than to an imbalance between population and food supply.
We're talking with Nick Culleter. He's a professor of history at Indiana University and the author of The Hungry World, America's Cold War Battle Against Poverty in Asia. He's featured in the PBS American Experience documentary, The Man Who Tried to Feed the World, which premieres tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern on your local PBS station. And we are taking your messages on social media, Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or your voicemails to 866-476-3881. We do have a listener voicemail now from John, who's listening in Michigan. Let's listen to that now.
Hello, my name is John Baxter. I'm calling from Michigan, and I would like to know if there is a really solid biography of the life of Norman Borlaug. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Nick, do we have that information for John?
Yes, there are a few biographies. The best one I'd recommend is by an author named John Perkins, who's one of the authors who appears in the documentary tonight. On the webpage for the PBS documentary, you'll see there's a bibliography there that lists a number of books about the Green Revolution and about Norman Borlaug himself. You can have your choice. I think there's one biography of Norman Borlaug that's four volumes long. Interestingly, Norman Borlaug at one time thought about writing his own autobiography, but he saw his own life in connection with the larger global story of man's struggle against hunger. And so he began his biography in the Neolithic age. Chapter three, he had not yet reached the 20th century. And at that point, he gave up.
Nick, I want to talk about the inspiration for your book, The Hungry World. What got you interested in this piece of world history, the mid-20th century, and what happened in Asia?
Well, the Green Revolution is generally seen as one of the huge success stories of development. And it's a unique story, isn't it? It's a story in which science and governmental action prevails over a major human problem. It's the kind of story that we hope will play out in relation to the COVID virus and in relation to global warming. To me, the story always sounded like the way in which it was told may not be quite true. That's often the case with historians. We kind of look for stories that don't quite ring true with our own understanding of how the world works. And then we dig into them to see what really happened on the ground. And so this looked like a good story to dig into to me. And it led me a lot of places because the story of the Green Revolution travels around the world. It starts, as I've said, in the United States. It moves to Mexico. It then goes to India. There's another huge chapter of it, which is really about rice, and it's located in Southeast Asia. The Rockefeller and Ford Foundations mounted a huge project to do to rice what Norman Borlaug did to wheat, which is to say, make it tolerant to large amounts of chemical fertilizer. It was a really tough job, but they created something called the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines, which experimented for years with varieties and eventually came up with a dwarf white rice variety that could absorb huge amounts of chemical fertilizer and consequently grow tremendous amounts of rice. And that had a revolutionary effect on the production of rice around the world. So I was interested in the big effects that were caused by this. And I was also interested in the nature of a story of science, political power, the Cold War, and American aid.
There are a lot of parts of this story that ripple into today. You just mentioned a couple of them. I want to get to the modern non-GMO movement, which on one hand is a protest against what some call Frankenfood. But the answer to that argument is that it's simply the modern scientific solution to producing enough food for the world's population to survive on. The other argument, though, seems to be the one that we've gotten into today, and that's one that has environmental, societal, and economic consequences. Fewer farmers producing higher yields, but at a cost of degrading soil and water quality, not to mention heavier pesticide use, as we mentioned just a little bit ago. Now, I'm not asking for your opinion here, Nick, of course. I just want your historical conclusion based on what you've studied and how you've seen it affect the present. Were Norman Borlaug's contributions a good thing overall?
That's a really hard question to answer. It's not something that could be avoided. In order to support the populations that exist in the cities of Asia, in order to support the kinds of industrial economies they have, this transition needed to take place. It wasn't just Norman Borlaug who did it. In some ways, the Nobel Committee had to choose a representative scientist to award this prize to. So it was a multinational, multi-pronged effort that it's hard to picture a world in which this doesn't happen. On the question of GMOs, I should say that Norman Borlaug sometimes called himself a genetic engineer, but what he was doing was not genetic engineering in the same way that we talk about GMOs. He wasn't tampering with gene sequences in any way. In many ways, what he was doing was a kind of traditional plant breeding that goes back all the way to the very beginning of human cultivation of foods. He did it on a much vaster scale. And one of the interesting parts of the documentary is that they show what that looks like and how that's done. But what he was doing was a pretty traditional type of wheat breeding. Nonetheless, nowadays when people debate the GMO issue, they frequently invoke Norman Borlaug as an example of what they're trying to do. What they don't do is talk about the surrounding circumstances that made Norman Borlaug's actions so politically powerful at the time and that are so different nowadays. It is the case nowadays that most economists don't believe that famines are caused by a shortage of food or by a surplus of population. They're caused by other things.
Nick Cullether is a professor of history at Indiana University and the author of The Hungry World, America's Cold War Battle Against Poverty in Asia. Nick, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Matt.
He's also featured in the PBS American Experience documentary, The Man Who Tried to Feed the World, which premieres tonight at 8 Eastern on your local PBS station. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.